Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 2, Text 7, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace, V.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Vasudeve Bhagavati,
Vasudeve Bhagavati,
Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha,
Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha,
Janyatyashu Vairagyam,
Janyatyashu Vairagyam,
Jnanam Chayada Haitukam,
Jnanam Chayada Haitukam.
By rendering devotional service unto the Personality of Godhead, one immediately acquires causeless knowledge and detachment from the world. Purport. Those who consider devotional service to the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, to be something like material, emotional affairs, may argue that in the revealed scriptures, sacrifice, charity, austerity, knowledge, mystic powers, and similar other processes of transcendental realization are recommended. According to them, bhakti, or the devotional service of the Lord, is meant for those who cannot perform the high-grade activities. Generally, it is said that the bhakti cult is meant for the shudras, vaishyas, and the less intelligent woman class. But that is not the actual fact. The bhakti cult is the topmost of all transcendental activities, and therefore it is simultaneously sublime and easy. It is sublime for the pure devotees who are serious about getting in contact with the Supreme Lord, and it is easy for the neophytes who are just on the threshold of the house of bhakti. To achieve the contact of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, is a great science, and it is open for all living beings, including the shudras, vaishyas, women, and even those lower than the low-born shudras. So, what to speak of the high-class men, like the qualified brahmanas and the great self-realized kings? The other high-grade activities designated as sacrifice, charity, austerity, etc., are all corollary factors following the pure and scientific bhakti cult. The principles of knowledge and detachment are two important factors on the path of transcendental realization. The whole spiritual process leads to perfect knowledge of everything material and spiritual, and the results of such perfect knowledge are that one becomes detached from material affection and becomes attached to spiritual activities. Becoming detached from material things does not mean becoming inert altogether, as men with a poor fund of knowledge think. Naishkarma means not undertaking activities that will produce good or bad effects. Negation does not mean negation of the positive. Negation of the non-essentials does not mean negation of the essential. Similarly, detachment from material forms does not mean nullifying the positive form. When the positive form is realized, the negative forms are automatically eliminated. Therefore, with the development of the bhakti cult, with the application of positive service to the positive form, one naturally becomes detached from inferior things, and he becomes attached to superior things. Similarly, the bhakti cult, being the supermost occupation of the living being, leads him out of material sense enjoyment. That is the sign of a pure devotee. He is not a fool, nor is he engaged in the inferior energies, nor does he have material values. This is not possible by dry reasoning. It actually happens by the grace of the Almighty. In conclusion, one who is a pure devotee has all other good qualities, namely knowledge, detachment, etc. But one who has only knowledge or detachment is not necessarily well acquainted with the principles of the bhakti cult. Bhakti is the supermost occupation of the human being. Hare Krishna. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojataha Janyatyashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayadahaitukam. By rendering devotional service unto the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, one immediately acquires causeless knowledge and detachment from the world. The verses in this series, in the second chapter of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, are the essential to understand, if at all one is to understand Srimad Bhagavatam. These key verses which give in summary form the essence of how to understand Bhagavatam. Otherwise there are many people studying Bhagavatam and other shastras, but because they are not aware of the principles described in this series of verses, they are unable to understand Bhagavatam, even though they may explain it in various ways which may seem lucid and feasible, but they have missed the point. They have not understood Bhagavatam. Just like, for instance, there are different theories in science. There are different theories of the origin of the universe, and there are theories that there is no origin. And all of the persons who expound these theories, they're all apparently intelligent people. And all of the theories, if you examine them, they seem quite good, even though they cannot possibly be all true. Solid state theory and Big Bang theory both cannot be true. They're contradictory. But if you examine, seems quite good. Seems like it should be correct. So many different theories. Interpretations of history. It's time to time you get someone coming up with a completely different, taking the same facts, adding maybe just a little masala here or there that wasn't known, or some speculation that wasn't there before. It could give a completely different slant on history. So it's a matter of interpretation or angle of vision, world view. What's the word in German they use in philosophy? The word Geltanschauung, something like that. Ah, you're German? Sounded very German. So, it means, what does it mean? Like a world view, a way of seeing the world. Geltanschauung. So, how do we see? How are we to understand? Just a few days ago, there was at the end of a class I gave, one man said, well, I want to study Krishna consciousness objectively and understand it objectively. And he's been coming to the temple programs for many years, and he's still studying objectively. And he may go on studying objectively for many millions of years and not come to any conclusion, because objectivity doesn't come to any conclusion by its very nature. It doesn't come to any conclusion. One thing is, there's no such thing as pure objectivity. We all have our preconceptions of everything. Everything we see, touch, taste, smell, feel, hear, or conceptualize, we do so from a certain viewpoint. We say neutral observer. There's no neutral observer. Everyone has an opinion. Science is supposed to be objective. That's this idea, objective observer. But the scientists are also biased. It's not that they're just completely neutral. If they were totally neutral, then they couldn't begin to hypothesize. If they were just totally without any opinion or idea or whatsoever, then all they could do is collect information, but they couldn't begin to try to stratify and classify it. So there must be some kind of bias or inclination toward some kind of idea. Otherwise one cannot view the world with the idea that we'll be totally objective. That is not possible. Everything we see, we tend to evaluate in terms of this is good, this is not good, this is nice, this is not nice. So some bias is there, and definitely the scientist, when he... Well, the standard process is observation, hypothesis, experimentation, and 99 times out of 100, throw it out the window. And maybe 1 in 1,000, or they'll say, yes, the hypothesis is true. But because it's only 1 in 1,000 or 10,000 that it's true, and the scientist wants it to be true, therefore he's trying to interpret it so that it will be true, although it's not actually true, so that it will appear to be true, although it's not actually true. So he's biased because he wants that, you know, my hypothesis will be right, and I'll show the other scientists. Scientists are not at all neutral. They're in great competition with it. They just show I'm a better scientist. My theory works. So they have a tendency to fudge the facts and figures, and they also they even if they don't deliberately do so, they have the tendency to see what they want to see. We see, everyone sees things differently according to our perception. In the words of Chanakya Pandit, one object is seen differently by different living beings. That which is seen as a lump of flesh by a dog is seen as a beautiful woman by a man, is seen as daughter by her father, or wife by her husband. So it's the same object, but viewed differently. The same Hitler who was despised by the British during the Second World War, the same person was a source of inspiration and admiration for Germans. It's the same person. But due to different perception or different values, they perceived him differently. They had a completely different way of considering who is this person. So here in this verse is discussed about knowledge. First of all, we should consider what is knowledge. Because what one person considers knowledge, someone else considers mythology. Just like we have this term Hindu mythology, which Hindus themselves use, not knowing the actual definition of mythology, which means mithya, false. But the British Indologists who studied Indian traditions and culture for the very purpose of undermining them, applied this term, mythology, to that. They deliberately used this term because the Hindus considered that this is fact, Shastra is fact, and they used the term mythology. Just by using that term, they gave the concept, they introduced the concept that is not real at all. And similarly, the term idol, the term, or there are different terms in Sanskrit, Sri Murti, Sri Vigraha. But they gave the term idol. An idol, it it means that which is a false pagan representation, anti-religious. It actually has this connotation. So, what is actually not? Even see, even the words we use, they have different connotations or different subtle meanings attached to them. Or even the intonation of voice. We may say thank you to someone, and according to the way we say it, it can actually mean I'm grateful. Or it can be said in such a way that just by the intonation of voice, it can be understood that the person's very sarcastic or he's angry, even though he's saying thank you. So, what is knowledge and how can it be acquired? Well, simply put, knowledge means to understand things as they are, not simply to know, because everything we know is understood in terms of everything else we know. So you can't understand anything in a vacuum. Everything is relative. Just like we know that Seattle is a city in Washington State. So to understand this or to know this means we have to have a concept of what a city is, what a state is, what particularly what Washington State is, that is part of the United States of America, which is a landmass situated between the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans, bordered on the south by Mexico and on the north by Canada, and so many things we have to, and it's part of the Earth planet. So everything we know is in relationship, it's understood in relationship to something else. The city, although when we say the word city, we don't immediately think of all the things that are in a city, but at least subliminally it conjures up the idea of roads, parks, people, stadiums, noise, endeavor, companies, families, so many different things. So, what is knowledge? This is a great subject of study for the psychologists, how perception, sensual perception, is collected and classified within the consciousness and understood. So this is the general way we consider how we attain knowledge, by especially in the modern age, this idea objective knowledge. We shall see. I don't believe it unless I can see it. It's another statement which sounds, well, nuts. It's very reasonable, isn't it? How can you believe in God or anything unless you can see it? So this is considered a trump card. You know that term? Don't play cards. But it's considered a winning proposition of the atheists. You can't show me God, then there's no God. Well, in this statement that if you cannot show me God, then there is no God, there are certain assumptions which are not necessarily true. The first assumption is that we have to be able to see something for it to exist. Now, we are told by our scientific friends that there are subatomic particles. Now, if we say, show me, they'll say, sorry, but we still believe they exist. We cannot see the mind, but we accept that it exists. So that's the very first assumption. Show me God. If I cannot see, then he cannot exist. So the first assumption is that we should be able to see something. Now, another thing is that even if we have the ability to see, we're presuming that God is, if we presume that if there is a God, the God that we don't believe in should be bigger than a subatomic particle visible to the naked eye. And the God that we don't believe in shouldn't be subtle like the mind. He should be big enough so that we can not see him. Whoops, wait a minute, what went wrong there? He doesn't exist, so we can't see him. But if he did exist, he would be big enough so that we could see him. It's pretty difficult logic to follow, but I'm trying to work it through here. So, even then, the God that you don't believe in, if you say that, well, the God that we don't believe in is about 6 feet tall or something like that, or maybe you want to say 6 miles tall because it should be bigger than the average man. But then what makes you think that you're qualified to see? Just like if you say, show me George Bush. See on the television, I know, but that's, it's all cheating. There's no real George Bush. It's just a big propaganda. Show me in person. Well, you think that George Bush, hey, listen, George, there's a fellow over here who wants to see you real quick. He's really insistent. Oh, okay, well, I'll just drop this White House meeting and immediately get in Air Force One and come out to Seattle and come in and say, I'm here. Oh, okay, George, all right, we accept you exist. So that's a foolish proposition. Who are we to say that George Bush must come immediately, otherwise I don't accept that he exists? And we can say, well, we can show you also Krishna, paintings of Krishna. We can even say that people, yeah, they've seen Krishna. So, I don't believe, I want to see in person. It's an unreasonable proposition that the God that you don't believe in should come immediately and show himself to you, so that you can reaffirm your non-belief. You want to say that I believe, I'll only believe if I can see him, but even if you see him, if you have the attitude not to believe in him, then you won't see him. Even if you do see him, just like we can say, yes, come to the temple, take darshan, Radha Krishna. You say, well, that's not God, you'll only see statues. And if we say, well, there was the real Krishna, of course the real Krishna is not at all different from deity Krishna, and he was present 5,000 years ago, Duryodhana saw him, but he didn't accept. He thought, this is my enemy. He didn't accept Ishvara Parama Krishna, Satyadananda Vigraha, Anadi Radhya Govinda, Sarva Karana Karana. And he should do something wonderful. You think that, well, we'll accept he's God if he does something wonderful. Well, Krishna did that also. He showed the Vishwarup to Duryodhana, and still he didn't accept. He thought, oh, it's just some magic. That's all. Sai Baba tricks. That's all. He didn't accept. So, what can you do? If someone is convinced that I shall not understand, then how will I understand? So the process of understanding reality is given here in this series of verses. And this theme is repeated throughout the Bhagavatam, that if one is to understand, first of all, one should understand one's total disability to understand. Jnane prayasam udapasya namanta eva. First of all, one should give up the foolish idea of thinking that our pea-brained selves stuck on this tiny little planet can understand what is reality by our own endeavors. Now, if we are to be at all objective, that should be the first thing we should consider. To consider that I can understand everything by my own brain power is not at all reasonable, considering how tiny we are, how limited our sense perception is, how limited our intelligence is, how limited our fund of knowledge, even that which has been laboriously uncovered by scientists, historians, philologists, geographers, geologists, and so many different kinds of ists and ers for the last few hundred years or so, it's still not very much. So we have very little knowledge, we have very little intelligence, we have very small lifespans. And how much can we understand about what is the nature of reality? So jnane prayasam, first of all, we should give up the idea of thinking that I can understand everything by my own endeavor. This is foolishness, proud foolishness, pride, to think that we can understand everything. We can understand so much. We shall be able to explain everything by our own endeavors. So this is pride to think so. But the Bhagavatam recommends, first of all, one should be humble. This whole chapter of Bhagavatam begins, Suta Goswami begins speaking. What is the first thing he does? He offers his obeisances to his guru, Shukadeva Goswami. Tamsava hridaya munima tamsava bhuta hridayam munimahanatosmi. I offer my obeisances to that muni who can enter within the hearts of all. So by humility we can be awarded knowledge, but by our own marching endeavors, Napoleon marching into Russia, by my own power I shall overcome. But just like all the American army put together cannot overcome Hurricane Rita or whatever it may be. So it's proudly marching, but certain of defeat. So Napoleon may think, well, I'm a great soldier, I have a great army, I'm expert, but he was defeated, not by the Russians, but by the Russian winter. So in the same way, we may think that by my own endeavor, or by the collective endeavor of the human race, we shall understand objectively. If we are actually to be objective, we should first of all consider our utter insufficiency to be able to understand even, let's see, a piece of paper. Bring all the scientists in the world and let them study this piece of paper and write reports on it throughout their whole careers. They cannot describe this fully. It is not possible. Everything, because, as I was saying, one thing is related to something else. So this paper, what kind of wood it was made from, how that wood or combination of woods or garbage or whatever it was made from is suitable for making paper, how the process, why it is so, what is the biomolecular combinations within the wood, how it has to be, how the wood, what season and what age the wood should be cut at, how it is processed, how it is dried. So many different considerations. What is the process for making the paper, the history of paper making, and then marketing it, how I came to write, to scribble some little notes on this. And then what is the atomic structure of the paper? Just that alone could take up all the scientists. Their whole lives. They don't even know what atoms are. They're not sure. Are they, if atoms even exist. So, there's no end to knowledge. What to speak of knowledge of the Supreme? So a different process is given here, that we can understand reality to some extent, but not by charging in and trying to conquer. This is the materialistic endeavor. We shall conquer over. It is the whole endeavor, the whole attitude that we shall understand, by our own objective means is symptomatic of the very disease by which we are incarcerated in ignorance, that we shall understand by our own endeavor. The very endeavor is defiant of Krishna. That even if you bring the Krishna, we shall also study Krishna in the university. That's also a subject. We have the geography box, the language box, the history box, and we have the Indology box. And one sub-box in the Indology box is Krishna. So put a label on him, Hindu god. Formerly a tribal god, became identified with the cult of Vasudeva. Worshipped in the modern age by the bhakti cult, descending from Ramanuja, Chaitanya, etc. Put it in a box, label it, and put it away. Yes, we understand. We understand Krishna. And this is offensive. The scientist doesn't understand the term offensive, or the objective examiner. He doesn't understand the term offensive, that I can, well, I'm just examining. What is your position to examine? What makes you think you should be the examiner? Rather, you are subject to be examined by Krishna, not that you should examine Krishna. You're in Krishna's box. Don't try to put him in your box. He doesn't fit. He fits millions of times more than you can imagine, and at the same time, everything is already within him. You cannot classify Krishna according to any mundane category. The very endeavor, I shall classify and understand. This means we're trying to take the position of God. Well, this objective method of knowledge means I look from my vantage point, I try to understand, I classify, and then yes, now I've understood. We're taking the position of God. He is the one to look down, and we are the ones that are the tiny little ants that are within his vision. So, he doesn't understand I can be offensive, that this very endeavor is offensive. Because he doesn't see that he can be offensive because he takes the position of God. I'm just the observer. But our position is not to observe. Our position is to be observed. Our position is to serve. Not that we shall gather more and more knowledge, and by doing so, we shall understand more and more, and then we shall control and we shall live happily. This sounds like it's another of those lucid, feasible propositions, is it not? We shall study more, we shall get more and more information and understand more and more things, and then we shall live very nicely. It sounds like a very good proposition, but it's demonic, because it denies our actual position of subservience to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So actual knowledge must be descending. If at all we are to understand things as they are, we cannot do so by our own endeavor. That should be the first point that any actual objective observer, the point he comes to. Otherwise, the whole basis of so-called rationalism is irrational. The idea that we shall understand everything by our own endeavor. It's irrational. And they call it rationalism. But the very beginning, the very basis, is not a difficult thing to understand. Then why don't they understand? Why can they not understand this? Prabhupada asks this rhetorical question in the beginning of his longest purport in Bhagavad Gita as it is, that there are many philosophers, politicians, philanthropists, scientists, and so on in human society. Then why can they not understand Krishna? And the answer is given here. And the verse is, Namaṁ duṣkṛṣino mūrha prapadyante narādhamāha māyā pahṛta jñāna āsuraṁ bhavam āśrutāha. They cannot understand Krishna because their very attitude is one that I shall not understand Krishna under any circumstances. Matiya na Krishna paratasvatova mito bhivadyeta grihavratanam. adanta go bhir vishatang tamisram punaf punas charvita charvananam. Their Krishna mati, their inclination toward Krishna, will never be aroused because they have taken a vow never to understand Krishna. Grihavrata, instead of being Krishnavrata, that our life is dedicated to Krishna, they are Grihavrata. Our life is dedicated to home and bodily comforts. And their senses are uncontrolled, therefore they chew that which is already chewed. Did you ever have the experience of sitting down on a park bench and then you want to get up and you're stuck? There's some chewing gum. Someone has stuck some chewing gum there, chewed and put it on the bench. You ever had that? It's not a very nice experience, is it? To be stuck with someone's chewing gum and it sticks on your clothes. Well, if that happens to you next time, you might consider thinking, well, it's chewing gum, free! I didn't even have to buy it. And you pull it off and you start chewing it. Is it a nice idea? Already chewed, and you're enough. Maybe your teeth will come out or something. It's already chewed, but you want to chew it again. So that is material life. Chewing the chewed. The chewed up chewing gum, and you want to chew it again. Because, it's a very good example, because sense gratification is, what is sense gratification? There is the idea that I shall enjoy by doing so. By having my senses interact with the sense objects, I shall derive enjoyment. But it's only in theory. Just like if you see the chewed up chewing gum, you think this will be, I shall enjoy by chewing it, but you don't enjoy. It's just an idea. Chewing gum looks like, even the fresh chewing gum, where is the enjoyment in that? Just like Pepsi or Coke. No one would ever buy Coke or Pepsi if they didn't spend billions of dollars advertising it, because it's not, what is it? It doesn't taste very good, as far as I can remember from, 35 years ago or so when I last took one. And what's so great about it? It's just some drink, that's all. There are so many other things. You can just drink water also. But why do people buy it? Because it's advertised. And they always, on the advertisement, they show happy people, isn't it? So the idea is there, by drinking it, I become happy. But it doesn't happen. It's just an imagination. And everyone knows they've drunk Pepsi so many times, and they know that when you drink it, you don't become like the people in the advert. Thank God, you wouldn't want to be like them anyway, but some people do. And so they go on and on drinking, maybe next time, or maybe next time. They don't think very deeply about what they're doing at all. But just they have the idea that I shall be happy by doing so. So this uncontrolled senses, which leads them to tamisram. Tamisram means darkness, means hell, means ignorance. So those who are seeking sense gratification, their inclination toward Krishna can never be awakened. And actually they cannot think deeply about anything. You cannot actually be a philosopher if the senses are not controlled. That's why in the modern age, even pretensions to philosophy are very, very limited. And of course, we meet people on the street, everyone thinks they're a philosopher. When you go to sell them a book, all of a sudden, they're walking along the street chewing a hamburger, and all of a sudden they become a philosopher when you give them a book. But actual philosophy, people have no idea. Even what they call philosophy in the West, they're so proud of Hegel and Kant and so many different. There's one famous British philosopher, among philosophers, he's famous. 20th century English philosopher by the name of, guess what, Iyer. Not a Tamil Iyer. He's an atheist. He's one of the famous propagators of atheism, at Oxford University professor. He's dead now. He's somewhere, licking his masters as the master pats him on the head, somewhere. Unless he was born as a dog in India. Well, they're also patting dogs on the head nowadays. Anyway, they're so proud of their philosophy, but actually, if we study what they call Indian philosophy, or what is Vedic philosophy, or the offshoots of Vedic philosophy. And it's just in such a completely different category to that of in the West. It's so shallow in the West and without any basis, because the asatyama pratishtante, they start off with the understanding that there is no basis of anything. So how can there be any philosophy? From the beginning, asatyam apratishtante. There's no actual reality. There's no basis to anything. Then what kind of philosophy are they going to have? It's like Buddhist philosophy. What is it, Buddhist philosophy? How can there be philosophy when the conclusion is that there's nothing? You can't even say in Buddhism, you can't even say there is nothing. Because as soon as you bring in there, that means there's something. There is means there should be something. But they say there is nothing. So it's a completely impossible. They have different schools of Buddhism who in the past debated with each other fiercely over the nature of nothing. It's all nothing, but our nothing is better than your nothing. Oh, this is the real nothing. Oh, wait a minute, but nothing's not real. It's just bizarre. So, this is the nature of maya aparita jnana. Their knowledge is covered. They appear to be very knowledgeable, but their knowledge is covered by illusion. The illusory power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by which different philosophers think that what they are proposing is correct. There was a time when people in Europe believed that if you sailed a ship west of Europe and you went far enough, you'd go over the edge of the world. You'd fall off the edge, because the earth is flat, and you'd fall off the edge. And now we may laugh at that, but at that time they were considered highly respectable scholars, and it was considered as an axiom of thought, and they considered themselves to be at the pinnacle of knowledge, just like we do now. And at that time, it was just considered a normal thing. Christopher Columbus, in his endeavors to go to India, he faced mutiny from his sailors, because they said, "We don't want to go any further west, we'll go off the edge." They fully believed it, and any endeavor to convince them otherwise ran into much difficulty, because they were convinced that it's very dangerous, we'll go over the edge of the world. So, in the same way, we have, in the modern age, theories which are incredibly foolish, which are accepted by and taught as knowledge. Man has descended from monkeys, and it's called scientific. And they have theories which sound feasible, as I read in the Encyclopedia Britannica. They stated, not maybe, but as a fact, although they have absolutely no evidence whatsoever, that the monkeys were running around in the jungle long ago, like all good fairy stories, once upon a time. And some of them were bigger by chance. Some were born bigger than others, and the bigger ones, they could reach up to the fruits in the tree and eat them. And so the taller ones, they became more nourished and they by eating the fruit, and therefore they survival of natural selection, they prospered. And because they reached up, then instead of running around, they became standing on two legs. They became human beings. What a great theory! It's not no theory, it's a fact. It's in the Encyclopedia Britannica. This is how monkeys became human beings. Right? Sounds true, right? That's what they're propagating. And you can see any number of popular science books, and they start off with once upon a time, and then they give so many billions of years ago. There was nothing, but all of a sudden there was a singularity. This is a very scientific term for it. But in nothing, if there's absolute nothingness, then first of all you can't even conceive of it, and then there's a singularity, means an oddity, and it was with infinite mass and infinitesimal size, which is also completely impossible, and then it exploded, and the first few seconds it became, you know, all those who read these stupid things, and they state it as a fact, although it's not in the slightest bit. They have pages and pages of mathematics to supposedly support, but it's just conjecture. So the endeavor to understand reality by the objective method is doomed to failure. And we may even have theories which are most ridiculous, which in future, just like we look back and say, oh, they believe that the earth was flat, and if you sail far enough, then you'll go over the edge. So presumably in future, people will look back and say, well, they believe that man descended from monkeys. How could they believe that? How stupid. Or they believe that the universe came into being by an explosion in the middle of nothing. And how could they believe that? How could they be so stupid? So the idea, I mean, even if you consider that such a great scientist as Einstein, he couldn't understand reality by the objective method, then what hope have we got if we're just to do it by our brain power? Generally it's considered that, well, there's no real competition. Einstein is the most intelligent person of the 20th century, isn't it? Who else is there? His great competitor is Niels Bohr, but he's not nearly as famous as Einstein, even though modern scientists say that his theories are better than Einstein's, at least in understanding. Well, Einstein was a relativity man, and Bohr was the quantum theory man. So Einstein is accepted as the most intelligent person of the 20th century, but he wasn't. And Prabhupada was unlimitedly more intelligent than Einstein. Isn't it?
Yes.
Now you may say, well, Prabhupada didn't make scientific theories. That's a symptom of his intelligence. Making scientific theories means we are fiddling around in ignorance. That's all. We don't know, and we're trying to understand. And we write down a bunch of numbers, and it seems right to us. But at the end of life, we don't know anything more actually about reality than when we started. Real intelligence means that first of all we should understand how to understand. If we don't understand how to understand, then we can very intelligently just like that, there's that story in the Mahabharata, how the storks in the pond. Stork means bucker. How do you say? You must have that, like crane, some kind of bird. Crane, they're called here. Okay, so they were in their pond eating snails, and they saw some beautiful swans flying overhead, and the swans came down for a rest. They said, oh, you look so beautiful. Where are you going to? Where are you flying to? We're going to Manasarovar. So they said, what is that? Oh, it's a very beautiful lake. And they described all the scenery, how nice it is. And so the crane said,
Let us, we can go with you. He said, yes, you can come with us. So he said, oh, all right, we'll go with you. And then all of a sudden, the most intelligent crane asked a very important question. Are there snails to eat in the Manasarovar? No, but we eat nice lotus buds. No snails? Then we're not going there. We'll stay in this stinking little pond and eat the snails. Lotus buds? We don't eat that. We eat snails. So it's like that, that what is our actual well-being, we're not even attracted to it because we're jaganya guna vrittisto adhoga chanti tamasa. We're attracted to that which is in ignorance. Rakshasim aso mokhasha mokha. What is that? Mokhasha mokha karmano mokha jnana vichetasa. Rakshasim asuring chaiva mohining prakritim shritaha. We're persons of demoniac intelligence. They are attracted to atheistic views, and therefore all their endeavors, all their hopes in activities or in philosophical research are all frustrated. So real intelligence means to first of all ascertain what is to be understood and the means to understand it. That should be the first thing. You can spend your whole life studying the mating habits of nocturnal frogs in the Amazon jungle and get a PhD for it and become famous among certain people who put value on such ridiculous things. And you can publish books and sell maybe 25 copies or something like that, and put in every, no more, such a book would be put in every university library in the world. And then it adds to the stock of human knowledge. We're promoting the human race because now we have so much knowledge about the mating habits of nocturnal frogs in the Amazon forest. So we can study. But what is the actual benefit? The actual benefit is that you yourself, you become a nocturnal frog in the Amazon forest because that's your focus of your life. All you're thinking about is frogs. You have to go out in the dark at the night and spy on them and listen to them, make recordings of their and then you become an expert with great endeavor, risking your life to be bitten by a poisonous snake, or so many. Real intelligence means, first of all, to discriminate between that which is actually beneficial and that which is not. There's so many things we could study in this world. We should discriminate between that which is actually beneficial for us and that which isn't. Therefore, Brahma Sutra begins, Atato Brahma Jignasa, not frog Jignasa, or even atoms Jignasa, nor computer Jignasa, but Brahma Jignasa. King Tad Brahma Kim Adhyatma. Arjuna asks, what is Brahma? What is Adhyatma? So, first of all, we should ascertain what is to be understood and how it is to be understood. We cannot bring our Bunsen burner to find out what is Brahma again, nor our ruler, nor even our Einstein brain. Einstein's brain was, or Einstein's intelligence was not capable of understanding the higher subjects. We think he's on a very high level. But actually he's on the low level because it's only aparavidya. Actually when we have these terms, paravidya, aparavidya, That means knowledge of transcendence and knowledge of the mundane. But even that aparavidya, knowledge of the mundane, specifically means knowledge of the mundane as presented in the Vedic literature. And Einstein wasn't even on that platform. He was on the speculative platform. So, he, although very intelligent, he was missing the point. And very intelligently brought up so many theories, but he didn't advance even an inch towards the actual purpose of human life, which is to understand who is Krishna, or what is the Absolute Truth. This understanding begins with Brahma Jignasa, inquiry into the Absolute Truth. So what is the Absolute Truth? Janmadyasya Yataha. That from which everything comes. That by which everything is maintained. Yatova imani bhutani jayante, yena jatani jivante, yat prayantya visang visanti, tad vijigyasasva, tad brahmeti. What is the Absolute Truth? That from which everything emanates, that by which everything is maintained, that by which everything is destroyed. This is the problem subject for inquiry. This is Brahma. And ultimately, what is that Brahma? Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram Paramam Bhava. That is Krishna. So Prabhupada was most intelligent. Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, all the acharyas, they have also systematically presented knowledge. But knowledge far beyond that. Einstein, even from the very beginning, Einstein was doomed to failure in his endeavors, because one cannot understand simply objectively. And even the scientists, they've come to realize this at some point, although it doesn't filter down to the school rooms. But at the higher levels, they've also understood that we cannot objectively understand anything, because we're not objective beings. The observer always puts his spin on what he observes. So these books of Srila Prabhupada, they should not be considered as simply some sentimental religious books or books meant for some particular class of religiously inclined persons. But as is stated here, Bhagavat Tattva Vijnanam, this is scientific knowledge of the Absolute Truth. It's also presented in categories. The scripture, to some extent, presents knowledge. Now, we may say, well, it's not very classified or categorized. It is, but not so much so, because that is done later by different acharyas. Especially Madhvacharya, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, very in the modern scientific style, you could say, is very much classifying different kinds of information. But the Shastra is presented in a manner which allows for the transcendental subjective experience of Bhagavan to unfold within the heart. It's not simply a matter of objective classification, and then we can understand Krishna. But Shastra is presented apparently in a non-classified way, or not very much classified manner, because this knowledge of Shastra is not simply to be academically understood, but it is to be experienced. The coverings of ignorance are to be cleansed away from the heart. The jiva is, by nature, being a living being, not merely philosophical, but even more than philosophical, satchit anandamay, eternal, full of bliss. And actually, it's eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. So knowledge is there, but also his nature, anandamaya, rasovai saha. The Supreme Absolute Truth is full of rasa. Rasa means that wonderful effect which arises from the interaction of the Lord with his devotees. So Srimad Bhagavatam presents us philosophy, but with rasa. And first of all, to remove the coverings of ignorance, and simultaneously inject within the heart of the aspiring devotee that knowledge of Krishna which awakens the bliss of knowing Krishna. When we say knowledge of Krishna, we should never think that this is simply some dry knowledge to be collected and stored away. But rather, this knowledge of Krishna is inseparable from love of Krishna, actual knowledge of Krishna. That's why the scholars in the universities, they can never understand Krishna because they have no attitude to love him. But the different potencies of the Lord, Sandhini, Samvit, Hladini, they do not exist independently. The potencies of existence, of knowledge and of bliss, they exist simultaneously. And among them all, Hladini Shakti, the bliss potency, that is the ruling potency on which the others, we might think the Sandhini potency, that the existence, that everything should rest on existence. But that's in the material sphere. In the spiritual sphere, everything rests on bliss. Existence exists for the sake of bliss. Bliss is not a product of existence, but existence is existence because Krishna desires to enjoy. So, all these points can be understood when one takes up Krishna consciousness. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha. Bhakti Yoga means to act in such a way that one acquires the consciousness, one is blessed with the consciousness. This is the point. By the grace of the Lord, not by one's own endeavor, but by acting in humility in a manner that is pleasing to the Supreme Lord, he will bless us so that we can understand him. And that understanding begins with standing under humility. And understanding means that we are now standing on its head, everything we have understood so far. Everything we've understood is all opposite, back to front, inside out. Completely different perspective. Instead of the perspective, Ishvaraham aham bhogi, self-centered, we have to see Ishvara Parama Krishna Satyadananda Vigraha Aham Hi Sarva Yajnanam Bhukta Cha Prabhurevacha. So there's a completely different angle on reality. Arslishyava Padaratam Pinashtam. I shall not be happy, but Krishna should be happy. Instead of thinking how I should be happy, how Krishna should be happy by my activity. So to awaken this understanding, as is stated here, with humility, one has to hear, and then bhakti yoga prayojitaha. One has to act. Then knowledge will come, and what is called vairagya, the vairagya of a devotee is of an completely different quality to that of a non-devotee. The non-devotee's vairagya, like Hiranyakashipu, vairagi. So many vairagi, but they are unattached because they are attached. They perform tapasya, or they become detached with the idea that in future I shall enjoy more. Or even the Brahmavadi, he becomes detached from matter because he considers it troublesome to himself. therefore I shall be detached from it, because it causes me trouble. It's a self-centered outlook. But a devotee who uses millions of dollars, who collects millions of dollars, is actually detached, whereas the so-called yogi who lives on air alone and doesn't even cover his body, even in the cold of winter, he is actually attached. The devotee is attached because he takes millions of dollars and doesn't... His whole outlook is not that this is something for me. He never considers it's for me. Only considers that this should be engaged in Krishna's service, that's all. So devotee's detachment is is actual detachment. He has no personal attachment to anything, but rather he sees that everything should be engaged in Krishna's service, whereas there is no actual vairagya or lack of attachment of those who are not devotees. There's no actual knowledge either. Even though they may be very learned scholars, they don't actually have the knowledge. Even they may be very learned in the Vedic literatures, or there may be scholars who they're very learned in Vedanta or Vaishnav studies. There are certain scholars in the university who can explain Gaurya Vaishnav philosophy or Ramanuja Sampradaya philosophy better than most persons who are practicing it. But they're not any closer to Krishna by doing so. Actually, they're probably further away, because they think I know when they don't know. So there was a comment by a famous, I mean among scholars, famous contemporary scholar, this David Haberman, I was told just recently, that a devotee had said to him that, well, you scholars, you're just licking the outside of the honey pot. That example is given. He said, yeah, but we can tell you everything about the honey pot, which you yourself don't know. Now, how it was made, or how much it costs, how much honey you can store in it. Actually, the real point of the honey pot is to taste the honey, and that they're missing altogether. So yes, you can explain, or even you can, even about the honey, you can explain what is its specific density, and what are its chemical composition, and how it's formed by the bees, but still you don't get any benefit from it, because you have to taste it to get benefit from it. So apparently they know more, but they're no closer to getting the actual benefit from the honey than one who never ever studied anything. It's time to end. Hare Krishna. All right. Hare Krishna. It's all over.